Welcome to Good Intentions, the podcast where we explore the world around us to find meaning and intention in what we do. I'm Kelly Harvard, and I'm on a mission to spread positive stories that will inspire you to live a more meaningful and connected life. What about dying? How do you feel about that? Why do some of us live longer than others? What does the latest science teach us that will help us not only live longer lives, but also to live fitter, healthier, and happier lives, even in our twilight years? Well, this week, my guest has all the answers where aging is concerned. She's Professor Rose Anne Kenny, who has 35 years of experience at the forefront of aging medicine. She's a Professor of Medical Gerontology at Trinity College Dublin, Director of the Mercer's Institute for Successful Aging, and founding principal investigator for the Irish Longitudinal Study on Aging. Her book, Age Proof, The New Science of Living a Longer and Happier Life, draws on her own pioneering research, and she's in Dubai at the Emirates Literature Festival, leading discussions on a life well lived. As you would expect, Professor Rose is an absolute goldmine of information when it comes to aging. And we had such an enlightening conversation about everything from misconceptions about aging to loneliness. And we also discussed how purpose plays a huge part in how we age. 80% of our aging is under our control, and a positive attitude is scientifically proven to help us age well. I loved how much science and data Professor Rose brought to the table, along with a healthy dose of practicality and useful tips. Please enjoy our conversation. Thanks so much for joining me today, Professor Rose. I'm really excited to talk to you on the Good Intentions podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelly.
You're going to come and feature at the upcoming Emirates Literature Festival, which is almost upon us. Very exciting. Could you just start by telling us a bit more about the book that brought you here or that is bringing you here and why you wrote it?
So I'm really looking forward to the Emirates Literature Festival. It looks like a wonderful lineup, and I'm enthusiastic to share some of the learnings from my book, Age Proof. How I came to writing Age Proof, the short version, is I've been over 35 years as a clinical researcher in the aging space. So that means that I'm a clinician, a doctor, professor of medical gerontology in Trinity College in Dublin, but I also do an awful lot of research in the area. Sometimes my clinical observations lead to research, or I've also been involved in a very large population study where we're understanding what the aging process looks like now for over a 12-year period. We've been following the same people, and it's very, very detailed, not just health issues, but a lot of social questions are asked of participants and economic questions. It's almost 10,000 people, and they're randomly selected from the population. So whatever observations we make, we can generalize. So it's very, very rich data. And the book is about sharing that data. Ireland is one of a number of countries now, sisters countries, who are running longitudinal studies in aging. And we've built those studies so that there is a common core of questions in order to compare different countries' experience of aging and the factors which are driving successful aging or issues with aging, etc. And of course, as everybody listening knows, a health issue doesn't occur in isolation. It's always complicated by either other health issues or something within a family circle, or something social or economic circumstances play a big, big role in health. So that's why the book was written, to share this rich tapestry of factors that influence the aging process.
Interesting. Absolutely fascinating. I'm fascinated by the whole sort of subject. So I'm really personally interested in this as well. I can't wait to get a copy when you come. I'm waiting to get my copy so that you can sign it. So,
so Kelly, but just to say, of course, everybody should be, because there's only one other alternative to getting older.
Precisely, absolutely. And there's so many misconceptions about it as well, and it's such an interesting topic to sort of delve into. I mean, one of the ones that I love, which I think you talk about in your book, is that only 20% of aging comes from our genes. 80% of it is lifestyle and attitude, you know, where you often hear people say, oh, yeah, well, you know, I'm this way, and, you know, my mom was this way, and my dad was this way, and actually that's just not true. So how does our attitude and lifestyle and all those things, how do they affect our aging primarily?
So this is one of the really good news stories, that 80% of the process of aging is actually under our control. It's dependent on our health behaviors and other behaviors. Now, we know about the health behaviors very well established is the positive benefit of physical activity and diet, etc. And we can talk about some of the other elements, but That's hugely important because most people have exactly that misconception you've nicely outlined there. Most people assume it's genes. And I see this frequently in clinical practice where patients will come in with heart disease and their lifestyle behaviors are still poor. I mean, they're overweight, excessive alcohol, sometimes smoking, etc. But they brush it off and say, it doesn't matter in my case because my mother lived to 89 and my father to 90. I don't need to worry. So that misconception is out there very much. And it's really important, and it's important at an individual level. So we are in control of our aging process, more or less. 80% of it for younger people is related to our behaviors. If you make it to 80 and you have a family history of longevity, then about 40% of the rest of your life is driven by that genetic makeup. So that's that scenario.
Gosh, so there's some really positive sort of statistics there that we are in control, which I hadn't really... I feel like the narrative around it is very different to that. And I'm really glad that you're exploring how different this really is. We can start to change that. And is this kind of what we mean, like, about when you say like attitudes, is this what we mean about like positive aging? Because we see a lot about this, like, what does positive aging mean? Is it having this better attitude and taking more responsibility?
So that question has always fascinated me. And we were able to work with psychologists to actually identify valid questions we could ask to try and determine a little bit more about this very thing, is what is positive aging and does it really make any difference? We actually embedded in the questions around your attitude to aging. And just to cut to the chase on that, it's, you know, do you feel your chronological age? Do you perceive yourself as being your chronological age? That's the number of candles on your birthday cake. Or do you perceive yourself as being younger? And I have to tell you now, I perceive myself as being about 20 years younger than I actually am. It always fascinated me, that whole question around positivity, because very frequently we see people who have a very positive attitude and everything about them also more youthful. We explored that. And bottom line, if you have a positive attitude and you feel yourself to be, you believe yourself to be younger than your chronological age, we've shown with repeated sampling that in fact, your aging process is slower than other people who feel their chronological age. But you might say, that's because the people who feel their chronological age have arthritis or other diseases or disorders. The way the data set is designed, we were actually able to adjust for that. So I can tell you that independent of having diseases or disorders or whatever else, your attitude independently influences the pace of aging at a biological level. Isn't that wonderful?
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, and a very good reason to kind of, you know, all these things we see about being grateful and having a gratitude journal, which, you know, sometimes I'm just like, I'm so busy. Do I have to also be thankful for everything all the time? But I guess...
Well, it's also important that at a societal level, we're aware of this, because sometimes we get negative vibes and messages, say from the media, for example, and everything is so youth orientated. But that has a sort of a subclinical negative impact on older persons' approach and attitude to aging. It must do. Because if you're constantly being bombarded by negative messages, then they embed themselves. And it's difficult for an individual to break through all of that and still be positive. So I think it's important that we're aware of that as a society. And look, if it influences your biology, it's a cheap way of delivering health behavior prevention, you know, prevention for diseases through health behaviors.
No, absolutely. And do you think, I mean, I completely agree with you about the media and the messaging and the narrative that we hear and that we're told. I mean, and I know that sort of like the UK and I'm sure Ireland, it's quite a sort of drumbeat of negativity, correct? So are there any countries, I mean, did you look in your study, are there any countries that are better at this than we are in terms of like that narrative and how they approach?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the USA is getting a lot better, believe it or not, because the proportion of people who are getting older is increasing proportionately in society, and they have a lot, their voice is loud. But Nordic countries are also very positive.
Countries. I went to a seminar a couple of years ago, which I still talk about because it's so fantastic. It was about positive aging, and I kind of went in feeling a bit negative about it. And I was like, you know, I'm not feeling so great, and I'm really interested in knowing more about it. And there was a lady in the room who basically was like, I can't wait to get older. It's fantastic. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. She saw it as such a beautiful thing. And I couldn't quite, she had an accent, but I couldn't work it out. And I said, where are you from? And I think she was Finnish. And she basically then explained how in her life, she was like, look, in my community, in my town, the older people, they're very integrated with us. And, you know, they go hiking and they live an active lifestyle. And she said, you know, that I look at them, they're aspirational to us. That is how we see it. Whereas obviously in other countries, it's very different. You know, older people are kind of locked away. And you're seeing, you know, and all this decline that you go into. And when she explained it, I was like, wow, this is a completely different mindset that I just obviously haven't been exposed to myself.
I think there's a movement now to change that narrative,
yeah,
and to repurpose it towards positivity. And it's really very important that we do that, because otherwise it makes it difficult for individuals. But, you know, because the demography is changing so much. I mean, we are living. We are actually living longer, three months every 5 years. The average life expectancy has doubled over the last 200 years. And next year, 12% of the total world population will be over 65. And obviously, you know, a quarter of the population in Germany is over 65. Now, over 65, 65 isn't old anymore. But I'm just giving you some sense of, we are living longer. Average life expectancy is increasing. We don't know exactly why. There's lots of things put forward, like new technologies, new medicines, less stress, believe it or not, better diets, more awareness of what health, how we can manipulate our own health, etc. But that doesn't appear to be the whole answer. And maybe there are other reasons why we seem to be living longer. The curve is pretty linear in most countries. In other words, it doesn't seem to be tailing off, and seems to be continuing to extend. That's life expectancy. And of course, fertility rates are dropping worldwide. So I think it was in 2012, the number of people, fortunately, over the age of 65 surpassed those under the age of 5 worldwide. So proportionately, there are more people increasing all of the time over the age of 65 compared to younger cohorts. Now, there may be issues with respect to labor force participation down the road in some countries with respect to that. But overall, it means that older persons are getting a louder voice simply because of numbers. And I think that will change the narrative around aging.
Sounds like a fantastic step in the right direction. I completely agree. And there's a section in your book, which I really loved, which is all about this sort of socializing and how this benefits us as humans, which sounds great, right? And obviously human connection is everything. It's part of the reason why I do this podcast. Like, I think, you know, with COVID, a lot more people realize perhaps we're a bit more introverted than we thought we were. So how can we kind of embrace this kind of socialize and get the best out of it without having to, you know, if you don't necessarily naturally mingle, you know, love to go out, love to meet with people, like, how can we get the best out of this?
So first of all, we are what's called gregarious animals. We need each other, and we've evolved to need each other. And that's why we've evolved in communities and why community is so important. You know, if you think of the hunter-gatherer model, which we've all evolved from, and those who went and hunted, if they didn't need the company of others and weren't gregarious, could have kept the meat, ate it, and moved on and left the others waiting in the village who were minding the youngsters, etc., without food. But we've evolved to need each other and to need each other's company, etc. And loneliness as an emotional state has also evolved with that. Painful loneliness actually accelerates dementia, for example. Painful loneliness contributes to a higher prevalence of cancer and heart disease. So it's bad for us biologically. And we've evolved that is the case. So it's incredibly important. Friendship is really important and very important for the whole process. And if you go out with your friends for a night, you have a good laugh. Laughter is part of all of this. Like, laughter is our way of socially bonding. And you have a good laugh at night. You know, you feel really good the next day. And that's not a chance thing. That's because biologically, that night of engagement and enjoyment has actually influenced your biology. I actually think that having a good social network and retaining that and retaining an interest in life and a purpose in life are probably the most important things that we can do to age well. And if you think about people, you know, in their 90s who appear to be in really good fettle or shape and appear happy with themselves, they have these components. You know, they're They're engaged. There's variety in their lives. They have social networks, etc. And they have a positive attitude. Just pause and look at people you know who have lived for a long time. Very few of them are miserable people.
Yeah, such a good point. I read a really fantastic piece in Time magazine. It was a couple of years ago now. It was a front cover story. And I think, so you know that as personally as I get older, I kind of fantasize about moving to the country and maybe I'll have a little farm. And it actually said that the happiest older people are people that live in cities, like quite big cities as well. You know, you think you want to escape from all this noise. And it said it's because of the connection. It's because you might get up in the morning, go to get your paper, go to get a drink. You'll connect with people. You'll see people. You can then do social activities because they tend to be in the center of cities. I'm not saying that they don't happen in the countryside. You know, I hate to go on the countryside, which I just thought was so interesting because, you know, I think I'd been programmed to think, okay, you know, I'll recede as I get older and I'll move away and it'll be this peaceful living on the side of the mountain. Actually, no, this isn't good for us. This connection is so important.
No, it's hugely important. That's a really good point because a lot of people make that mistake. They retire and they move. And you're not, Lisa Berkman in the States has done lovely work around our social networks. And even what you've described there, the paper man, you know, in the local shop, that's part of your network. You know, we've got our close network with our family and friends, etc. Then we have friends who we might meet on the way to the paper shop and stop and have a chat with, etc. You know, so your circles are very different. And then you've got the people in the shop itself, etc. But they all matter and they all influence your state, your biological state. So if you move away to an area where you don't know anyone, and this is not uncommon when people retire, you have to start again. You have to start developing and building those relationships again. Some people are very good at that. But my word of caution would be don't underestimate how important those transient social engagements are and networks that you've become used to in your immediate environment.
Gosh, that's so interesting, isn't it? There's when I go into my office building, there's a couple of security guards on the front desk and we always say good morning and I always chat to them whilst I'm waiting for the elevator and I really look forward to seeing them. And it's these kind of small connections that actually I live for as much as obviously, you know, my husband and my child and my bestest.
Correct. So the earlier people start to develop friendships and retain friendships, the better. And the title of the book is Age Proof. And unfortunately, that in one way attracts an older audience. But I really want to get the message to people in their 20s, 30s and 40s. It's then that you have to start shaping your future in order to have the maximum benefit when what inevitably happens.
Interesting. So fascinating. So you touched on it very quickly just earlier. So purpose, like if you have a purpose and a reason for getting up in the morning, and I love this stat, like you'll live about 7 years longer. I mean, incredible. So how can we find our purpose? Because I think purpose often sounds so lofty, like, you know, I'm finding a cure for cancer or I'm planning to climb a mountain. But how can we just find a purpose in our day to day that gives us something and gives us a reason to sort of get up in the morning that will help us live this more fulfilled life?
So it doesn't really matter what your purpose is, as long as you meaningfully pause and identify it as purpose and even make a list. So today I'm going to hose down the garden, clean out those shelves, go for a long walk, swim in the ocean, whatever. But you have a purpose for the day. It's getting up listlessly and just moving through the day without having clear focus of what you are trying to achieve with the day. That isn't particularly good for us. When we're working, it's different, because you're very clearly orientated towards your work, focused on that, and that gives you great purpose. And also don't underestimate the social engagement associated with that. One of the issues with retirement is that suddenly all of that matrix is taken from you. And not infrequently, people feel they've lost purpose once they give up work. So you have to be prepared for that and then to focus on, okay, what's my purpose today going to be? What's my purpose today going to be? It's really... there's great evidence to show that if you volunteer, if you're part of an organization which is helping others, that gives you great purpose and a really good feel good feeling emotionally, which is good at a biological level. Now, our work has shown that, in fact, if you don't start engaging with volunteering before retirement, you're very unlikely to do it after retirement. So it's good to start this process early. But to know that purpose isn't just about work or what we normally identify it with, it can be anything, as long as you make that thing your purpose. And in Okinawa and Sardinia, which are two of the blue zones where proportionately people live longer and healthier than on mainland Japan or mainland Italy, for example, in those two circumstances. They have special words in their language for having a purpose for the day.
Wow.
Recognizing how important it is.
Gosh, that's beautiful. I love it. So we all know that we're going to be living longer, and, you know, we're talking about things like purpose and finding a reason and planning our days. I mean, how can we plan and prepare for these sort of next decades? Like if I'm in my 30s or my 40s, like is it worth starting to think about it now? If I'm going to, like, what can I do to plan and prepare for it?
But it isn't just about preparing for the future. It's making things better for now. Because everything that decelerates, slows down the aging process, is actually good for you now. Everything we've talked about. So creating a circle of friends is important. Engaging is important at all ages. Having a purpose is really important at all ages. It's just that when we're younger, they're almost automatic within our lifestyles. Not necessarily so, but almost. And then as we get older, maybe by not being aware of their import, we're inclined to let them slip. But of course, the earlier you start, the better. And it's not just preparation for the future. It's about now. It's about being healthier now, feeling better now, preventing illnesses and preventing negative mental health issues now.
Yeah, no, very good point. How do you personally feel about getting older? I have to ask you.
Oh, well, the more I read about this, the more I realize, oh God, I wish I'd known that 20 years ago. Definitely that. I adore the work I'm doing, so I hope I never stop doing that. It's raised my awareness about the importance of volunteering, and I've volunteered. I'm on different foundation boards, etc., to raise money for different charities. So that's the case. I would be, and I'm very informed about the whole process. Am I really looking forward to it? I would be tentative about the process, definitely. And the thing that worries me most is I see our health services fragmenting, unfortunately. And I know that comorbidities, that illness, has increased with advancing age. And I know how you can decelerate that, prevent it, delay it, but it is inevitable at the moment. And I am concerned about access to good healthcare when it's needed. And I'm a physician, so.
Gosh, yeah, you're seeing it and living it every day, I guess. So you're, it's
in Ireland, the proportion of people over the age of 80 is going to increase fourfold over the next 20 years. And I see a big, big issue in terms of our healthcare delivery. It's the same in the United Kingdom and in most of Europe. And I'm sure it will be the same as populations age in other countries.
And yeah, I wanted to ask you about this a bit. So the UAE, Dubai, I mean, have you been to Dubai before? Will this be your first?
I have indeed. Yes, I have. Yes. Yeah, I liked it very much, actually.
You came from a couple of events, didn't you? I remember reading about them. So it's a very young country. Dubai is a young city. It's actually quite rare to sort of see older, you know, elderly people here. So how can we sort of find like healthy models of what older looks like if you're not necessarily seeing it sort of on a day-to-day basis? Do we have to look outwards or do we have to motivate ourselves? Is there a way of doing that?
So that's a really good question, actually. I think it's reasonable to hypothesize that it's in predominantly youthful societies that you would actually encounter most ageism and negative attitudes towards aging, because you don't, as you outlined, have peer models of aging on which to base your assumptions. And I think probably awareness, and as has happened in other countries which have higher proportions of older persons, it will come with time, but it's difficult for those who are aging in those societies. And, you know, earlier on when we were chatting, you made a really good point about women versus men and aging. And there's no question that, particularly in that sort of a societal structure, it's more challenging for women because of attitudes. And those attitudes feed back into an individual's self-perceptions of how they're aging. And people invalid and become less engaged because of those perceptions and because of their own perceptions of how they're aging. That is certainly the case, and it's something we need to be aware of, I think, and more supportive of women aging. And peer models are so, so important in that context. And to see women, as we do men, for virtues other than physical attributes. That is a huge, huge issue, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the UAE is doing a huge amount in terms of sort of supporting women. Sheikh Mohammed passed a law where now every business has to have, you know, a woman on the board. Like, there's a lot to do to sort of push women forward. I think the point's about, yeah, I mean, moving away from the sort of appearance-based culture, absolutely. And just as a woman yourself, I mean, how do you find that? Look, you know, I'm my time's marching on for me, and I always feel like there's a bit of a balance. You know, I'm trying to live a sort of healthy, spiritual, connected life with meaning, but, you know, I still really like to put mascara on in the morning. Like, how do you kind of balance sort of this sort of external with the internal and the whole aging process yourself?
I think it's really important to smile. And your first few seconds with somebody determine their approach to you. And if you're pleasant and smile really early on, it makes a huge difference. And I think it circumvents mascara and everything. I do use makeup. It's not that I don't use makeup, etc. But I just think that there's something deeper than that, innate, that we engage with. And smiling is one of those things. And that comes back to gregarious behaviors and needing people and feeling warm towards people and knowing that you can have an engagement with that person. I mean, I work in a hospital. Sometimes it's crazy and you have hardly time to brush your hair, but it doesn't matter as long as your attitude is positive.
Well, it's so interesting you say that, because there's a fantastic psychologist called Sean Acor. He's a professor of happiness at Harvard. Anyway, he's been on Oprah. He's that kind of guy. He's very prolific. He cites a study, and it was in a hospital in the States, and they asked all the doctors to smile at people. They said, you've got to smile like 10 times a day at patients, at people, whoever you see. That was all they asked them to do. They didn't change anything. And then they surveyed the patients afterwards and said, you know, how did you feel about your experience? Everybody had a fantastic experience at this hospital, even people that were not necessarily very well, that were quite unwell. Healing rates went up. All they did was smile at people. And he cites this study as a reason why, you know, you should. He said that him and his wife, where they drive around, where they live, their smilers and wavers. And me and my husband have kind of adopted this. My mom was in the car with me. She went, do you know these people? I'm like, no, I'm just smiling and waving. 9 times out of 10, people smile and wave back as well. And they don't even know you. So this is kind of, it's infectious.
But the person who's smiling feels better as well.
Exactly, right.
So the medical staff will have felt better as well as the patient participants.
Yep, exactly.
Because so smiling makes a difference, and it's part of that whole social engagement phenomenon.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I find it absolutely fascinating. So I wanted to ask you, and this podcast is called Good Intentions. It's all about sort of how we connect and ground ourselves. I mean, how do you stay grounded and connected? You've clearly got this very challenging job, and you're doing all this research. You're very busy and stretched. How do you stay connected to what's important to you?
There's a great research around giving and how giving makes the individual who's given feel better. And it pertains to monetary giving as well as any other form of giving. And I enjoy very much mentoring young doctors, young students, young clinicians, young healthcare professionals coming through and engaging with those. And my work lifestyle necessitates, obviously, engaging with all age groups. So I think that intergenerational transfer is very, very important, and I really love it. Networks are not from one age group. I often am friendly with younger people who are a lot younger than me, and I get so much from them in terms of social awareness, as well as people who are a decade or more older than me. So my friend network outside of work is wide in terms of age range. That's unusual, but really good and healthy. And I suppose that's one of the things over the years as I've studied all of this that I was aware of, and I've made a conscious effort to have that spread in friends from different age cohorts. But it isn't common. It's much more common in Southern Europe than in the UK.
Yeah, interesting. Obviously, there's your book, which is fantastic. Are there any other books that you would recommend? Are there any books that have sort of really meant something to you that you could recommend to us? And it could be about factual, it could be fiction, anything at all.
So of the kind of factual ones that I've really enjoyed reading, I love Malcolm Gladwell's books. I think he writes really well, and he's able to repurpose something that's quite complex psychologically into something which is easy to understand. Matthew, sleep is really important. We haven't touched on sleep, but sleep is so important for our biology. And I think Matthew Walker, again, has unpacked different personality subtypes, chronotypes, and sleep, and how they're all linked, and how sleep is so linked to dietary intake, etc., in a simple way. And I've condensed some of the sleep research from many different groups in the book, but sleep is very, very important, and I like the way he does that. And I love Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene. I think that is kind of a very quirky way of looking at our genetics and how we've evolved.
Sounds super. I also loved that, the sleep book, because I have struggled with sleep, and I just found it, yeah, God, I was literally like all the way through and making notes. And yeah.
And a lot of people do struggle with sleep. And the issue is, so many people, after I've given one of these lectures or whatever, would come up afterwards and say, oh, it's all very well to say about sleep, but I worry so much about the fact that I don't sleep well. And my retort is, it's much more important that you don't worry about it, because worrying about it makes it 10 times worse. You know, do what you can, but don't worry about it beyond that, because that's your physiology. That's you. Once you've taken on board everything else, then that's you.
Yeah. Self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? To keep worrying about it, I guess.
Yeah.
And last question. Why do you think we're here? What's our purpose on Earth?
Ooh. Well, of course, I very much believe in evolution. I know that to be the case, how we've evolved, and how we've evolved from right through from being a single cell to aquatic creatures and now land dwelling creatures predominantly. Why we are here, my own view is that it's chance, and that there may be other living mammals even, but organisms on other planets. I mean, it's so vast. How do we know? How can we say? And I think our presence here is a chance occurrence. It fits very much with what we know of molecular biology, etc. A lot of it is terribly ad hoc. I mean, there's very often when you go to look at why and you go back to the molecular structures, basic proteomics and all of the things we can get at, there isn't actually rhyme nor reason to why all of those mechanisms and systems and pathways have evolved, etc., which is why it's quite complex to learn, because there's nothing intuitive about a lot of it. So that kind of chance, chaotic way of evolving makes me think that it's pure chance that we're here and the way we've evolved.
Super interesting, fascinating, and what a great point to end on. Thank you so much for your time. I absolutely loved our conversation, and I can't wait to I'm going to be at your session fangirling you in the audience in February. It's not long now, is it?
I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah, that'll be great. Okay, thank you, Kelly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Good Intentions podcast. You can find links to issues and to books that we discussed in the show notes, and you can look for the podcast on Instagram. It's Good Intentions UAE. Please do make sure you subscribe to the podcast, and if you enjoyed this conversation, I'd so appreciate a review on whatever platform you're using. It helps more people find out about the podcast. See you next time.